Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ on this Monday, New Year's Eve. Thanks for listening.
Today, we've curated features and interviews that help put into perspective the year we've had and have a little fun while doing so.
For many years into the future, no doubt we'll still be talking about the waves of political news that define 2018, from presidential orders, FBI investigations, the death of late Senator John McCain, and an election season that was anything but predictable. And we covered it all. One topic we discussed was the idea of Republicans switching to the Democratic Party. Grant Woods served as Arizona's Attorney General from 1991 to 1999 as a Republican. But Woods has recently spoken seriously about switching to the Democratic Party, saying he's having a difficult time being in the GOP in the age of President Trump.
I haven't changed, but the party has changed. And if it wants to be the party of Trump, that's not me. These are not ordinary times. The country, I think, is really in a chaotic, difficult place. So I think I have to do some real soul searching and see and just make a decision here.
Woods isn't alone in the party switch discussion in this current election cycle. Republican Corporation Commission nominee Rodney Glassman was the Democratic U.S. Senate nominee in 2010. But Woods is especially high profile because of his connection to the late Senator John McCain and the eulogy Woods gave at McCain's Phoenix Memorial Service.
He believes so much that this, in the end, when it's all said and done, this Republican-Democrat thing's not that important, is it? We're all Americans, and you've got to get to the point where we can work together as Americans.
Former legislative leader and current public policy analyst Chris Hurstum also switched parties from Republican to Democrat 3 years ago, long after he was out of elected office. Hurstum told me he believes Woods will indeed make the jump to the Democratic Party before the end of the year.
Grant Woods is very serious about changing parties, not going the independent route, but becoming a Democrat and perhaps running for the U.S. Senate seat in November of 20, which would mean he'll start running next year, 19. The likelihood is very good of that. I think you will see Grant Woods definitely leaving the Republican Party. And of course, the elephant in the middle of the room these days is Donald Trump. Mm-hmm. That was the final straw for me when I saw Donald Trump coming down the escalator of the Trump Tower. The fact that he would be a legitimate Republican candidate and could possibly win the nomination, I didn't want any part of that. And so that's what finally pushed me to change parties.
You're a former elected official. It's been a while. But would your perspective have been dramatically different? And how much of that is being calculated by Grant Woods right now? Because when you are a private citizen, and you say, I'm frustrated with this party, I'm going to change. And because we know you well, it was significant to us, but the broader public perhaps didn't really care. But if you're running for office, you're running for U.S. Senate, you were elected as Attorney General as a Republican, now running as a Democrat, how much does the calculation change when you're an elected official or running to be an elected official?
Oh, it changes dramatically. You have to be much more calculating. If indeed you want to run for office again, you've got to factor all that in. For Grant Woods, he isn't going to win a Republican primary. Jeff Flake knew it and got out. So he really has no future. If he wants to run for office again, Woods has no future in the Republican Party. So he has to decide, do I run as an independent or do I run as a Democrat? Grant will have to go through a Democratic primary, and that's the biggest obstacle for him. Will high-profile Democrats like Ruben Gallego, et cetera, step aside and allow Grant Woods to come in and win the Democratic Party primary? They'll all do polling. They'll all decide whether they want to play it safe and stay in their safe districts. So that is yet to be determined. But it is definitely a definite different calculation for somebody who thinks they still want to run for office and a private citizen. What also is very different for Grant Woods right now, and it's really the thing that has precipitated this whole discussion, is the eulogy that Grant Woods gave in the Baptist Church on North Central in Phoenix, Arizona at John McCain's memorial. It was superb. And you saw Grant Woods as a personality. Not only were the things that he said touching, but he had a sense of humor. He talked about his past. He was able, it reminded people of his close connection to McCain. And it gave him a new platform that he hadn't had in years.
This is a moment in time then, in a lot of ways. So in this sense, Grant Woods can carry on what he had at the eulogy, the fact that he had this great history with Senator McCain, and also even when he was Attorney General, he had an independent streak to some extent as well.
Yes, he did.
So let me ask the cynical question then. So even if he starts running, and he actually determines he's going to run, starts early next year to raise money and whatnot to be ready for 2020, because of the uniqueness of Senator McCain and the uniqueness of their relationship and the uniqueness of that eulogy, how much momentum does Grant Woods carry, considering as well he would be jumping to a new political party? But it does seem chancy in terms of actually getting elected.
Yes. Don't underestimate Grant Woods as a politician. He's going to use this moment in time to springboard and become a Democrat. And he has a lot of positive press and a lot of great reaction from voters because of it. But he will instantly be on the attack against Donald Trump. And that'll be much easier to do as a Democrat. He will be a very aggressive guy that's message also to fellow Democrats will be, I can win this seat. You may be able to find somebody in the Democratic Party that has been in the party longer, but look at the polling data. Let me show you the polling data. I can win the seat. This guy or this gal who's running for the primary can't.
There are definitely potential pitfalls for candidates or already elected officials who make the party switch. Christian Gross, Associate Professor of Political Science and Public Policy at USC, has studied the electoral consequences of party switching by incumbent members of Congress. He explains that trust becomes an even greater challenge.
The research I've done shows that people who went from becoming a Republican to a Democrat or a Democrat to a Republican would have trouble connecting with the new party during the primary stage, right? So if a Republican becomes a Democrat, Democrats might not trust them immediately, and there may be a primary challenge from somebody who'd been a Democrat their entire career. And then similarly, if the person made it to the general election, that party switcher still didn't do as well in the general from people who were in the older party.
Is there a deeper theory there for you? Because it certainly makes perfect sense, to me at least, from the primary standpoint. But in the general election, you have people from both parties, you have independents voting, you have people not affiliated with a party who may not feel that sort of, did he betray us or can we trust him?
Yeah, I mean, in the general election, the theory is more of a consistency, right? And so if you think about somebody like John McCain, who was a maverick and would vote conservatively and then would vote more moderately, his party label remained constant, which allowed for him to have that consistency in terms of presentation of voters. When somebody switches parties, especially who's already been elected as the other party, it just creates inconsistency in the voters' minds, almost like a flip-flopping. And so that's where there's an electoral pitfall. It's less of a problem if the person has never held office before, right? So if you think about in California, Arnold Schwarzenegger was Republican governor, but he had been identified as an independent previously. Other people have run for office and had been Democrats and become Republicans, but it's before they run that they make the switch. And then that switch is less, there's less research on it, and it's also less problematic because the voters haven't identified you with that party already because you're introducing yourself to the voters in the new party.
Grant Woods, who is here, was elected as Attorney General of Arizona back in the 90s as a Republican, but he hasn't held office for about 20 years. Is there anything to indicate that, yes, he did hold elected office, but it was such a long time ago? Any reason to think that's the sort of thing that would weigh on someone, or does it have to be fresher in voters' minds?
So it needs to be fresh in voters' minds, but it could still be an electoral pitfall. Again, in a potential primary, I think is where I would see it as the main issue. So if he's able to clear the field in the primary, it may not be that big of an issue. But, you know, I think about various anecdotal cases. Arlen Specter was a Republican senator, served for a long time, became a Democrat because he said the Republican Party left him and ran in the primary, and he lost in the primary due to a lot of attacks of him being a Republican or him being a former Republican. My advice to him would be to get out in front of that and to define himself as a Democrat and to talk about how the party's different under Trump than it was in the 1990s.
Christian Gross is an associate professor of political science and public policy at USC.
One of the most harrowing parts of journalism is covering mass tragedies, and it seemed 2018 brought too many of them. In October, we reported on the Pittsburgh synagogue shooting, which left 11 people dead. In November, a man entered a bar in Thousand Oaks, California, and began shooting. 13 people died. And then there was the Parkland, Florida shooting inside Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School. There, 17 students, teachers, and administrators were killed.
Beyond the grief and anger after these mass shootings, an unsettling pattern has emerged. Survivors and victims' families grieving the loss of their loved ones also find themselves the targets of harassment. It happens online and in person. Conspiracy theorists charge the whole event was a hoax. They're told they're liars, and they're called, quote, crisis actors. No one knows the pain of this type of harassment more than Lenny Posner. His son Noah was the youngest child murdered at Sandy Hook Elementary in 2012. Since that day, he's had to deal with, deflect, and confront what he calls hoaxers.
Our co-host Lauren Gilger spoke with him about Honor Network, the foundation he started to raise awareness of this type of harassment and help other families after a mass shooting.
The conspiracy theories, I became aware of them very quickly. Now, for the first couple of weeks after the tragedy, I wasn't looking at any media. I wasn't even logging onto the web and doing any searches on news. But as soon as I did that in January, I noticed that there was the talk of crisis actors, and that was already going on.
What was your reaction to that?
Well, I was definitely pissed off at the time, but I wasn't surprised. I had heard of all of these types of theories. I just never had them directed at me directly. And so that was very different, but I wasn't surprised about seeing it.
So you found out these theories are out there, but this also has been really tough in your own life. Like, describe for us, how have you had to change your life as a result of this?
Well, because I started to push back with some of the comments that were being sent, some of the videos that were being posted, I made myself a bigger target than I originally was. And being trolled, I needed to sort of protect my privacy a little bit more. I would get my mail at a P.O. box. I would be very careful about having my address posted, but they would still do background checks on me and they'd determine where I'd live. So I'd have to move. I've moved frequently.
I guess the thing that strikes me about this is you've already had to suffer this terrible tragedy with the loss of your son at such a young age. And then to compound that, you've had to deal with all of this, these hoaxers, as you called them, afterward. And you're not the only one, obviously. How do you feel about that?
Well, I'm accustomed to it now, but it certainly is not a comfortable place to be. There seems to be no safety net, so that when you fall through, bottom, you just keep going. And the web is largely unregulated. So this manifests in so many different ways, from attacking and trolling. It's this mob hate momentum that goes on the web.
Were you surprised by the fact that you couldn't really do anything to stop it? Like you said, it's pretty unregulated.
I was at first. I was pretty surprised, and I was surprised at how much the police is really not interested. The police would generally say, just turn off the computer. They don't really want to deal with any of this, and they don't know how to deal with some of this. They don't really understand it. And then at the same time, they don't connect how stressful it could be for someone who's already been traumatized, and now they're being re-traumatized by trolls that are getting some sort of dark pleasure in doing this.
Are there existing laws that can be used to try to stop this kind of harassment?
Well, it depends on how extreme the harassment is and if it goes to the point of making threats. So there was a woman who was arrested for making death threats against me. But if they're if the threats are very vague, if the harassment is along the lines of posting photos of where you live, posting your personal information, that's not against the law. So I've filed multiple police reports, and usually the reports are not pursued by the police. And I've even spoken to state's attorney's offices, and most of the time, they're not breaking the law. So right. There are not enough laws.
This is tricky territory, though, legally, right, with the First Amendment. So for you, when do you think free speech sort of crosses over into harassment here?
Well, my understanding of free speech is that has to do with an open press or to criticize your government. That's not to sort of attack victims.
So is there any recourse? Is there anything that you've been able to do with this foundation that you've created or working with other victims to try to ease this?
Well, one of the things that we've been doing is we have been removing online content that's harassing content. Different platforms that host this content have a variety of different rules, and so we see when those rules are violated. So they have terms of service and acceptable use policies. One of the long-term plans that we have is to make platforms more aware that the group that's being targeted is or should be a protected group or a protected class, because victims need to be recognized as, they have a category for disabled, so maybe that would apply. So that's one of the avenues we've taken also.
You said that because you spoke out about this, you made yourself more visible and more targeted in this. Do you think that's been worth it, though? Do you feel like this work has been important?
I think the work is very important. I don't measure how much worth it has compared to how it's disrupted my life. They have attacked the memory of my son. I think it's definitely been worth it.
What do you want people to know about him?
He was a regular 6-year-old kid. He was a happy boy that went to school one morning and was in his classroom.
Len Posner, thank you so much for the time.
Thank you.
It's the show for Monday, December 31st. Happy almost New Year's. In the 1960s, astronauts like Neil Armstrong, Buzz Aldrin, and John Glenn were household names. But today, NASA astronauts are largely anonymous, and it's the people funding space travel that are more well-known, like Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos. Chris Davenport writes about this. He covers the defense and space industries for The Washington Post, which, by the way, is owned by Bezos. He's also author of the book Space Barons, Elon Musk, Jeff Bezos, and the Quest to Colonize the Cosmos. And Chris, in your article about this, you write about some of NASA's new astronauts, and it seems like in some ways their roles are the same as they've always been in the sense of what they're actually doing, but in some ways it seems like their roles are different. Do you think that's a fair assessment?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, they're similar in that, they still get on rockets and go to space and, are on the International Space Station, which has been continuously inhabited since 2000. And, they go to space and we see those images of them, twirling in a weightless environment and looking down on Earth from a distance. And, in more recent years, they've gotten really active on social media and But they're not in many ways like real explorers. I mean, we go to the International Space Station, which is 250 miles up. And, we've been doing that now for many years without pushing further into space. And, those first astronauts, those explorers who really were opening up frontiers at the beginning of the space age were real sort of national heroes and held a really significant spot in the public's consciousness and were really a part of, I think, the national identity. But today, more than 550 people have been to space, and to be a NASA astronaut now is to be somewhat anonymous, even though they could sort of continue on that legacy.
How do the astronauts feel about that? I mean, I would imagine they wouldn't all say, yes, we'd like to be rich and famous and have ticker tape parades for us, but are they cool with being anonymous?
Well, I mean, I think that, they're very sort of self-effacing and they're there, would tell you that they're there to serve. But I think within the astronaut corps and, just in the space community in general, there is a desire to push deeper into space and to really explore and push the boundaries the way we once did. And now, I mean, a lot of people forget and don't realize that the United States government, NASA, does not have the ability to fly astronauts to space from U.S. soil. And now we pay Russia to fly our astronauts to the space station. I mean, it costs something like $80 million a seat. But we're at a critical time now where the U.S. is trying and is pretty close to restoring that capability to U.S. soil.
One of the lines that you wrote in the piece struck me as particularly interesting. And you write, in the digital age, the mantle of the right stuff is being bequeathed to the engineers and the programmers who are collapsing the line between pilot and passenger one line of code at a time. And I think that kind of goes to what you were just saying about
how all these people have now been to space, but there isn't as much actual space exploration happening anymore.
Right. And what's happening now that you're seeing is NASA has partnered with private companies. And so SpaceX, for example, the space company in outside of L.A. that's founded by Elon Musk, is under contract by NASA to fly its astronauts to the space station, and first flights could be late this year or more probably early next year. And you're seeing a whole host of commercial, you know, companies like Jeff Bezos's Blue Origin or Richard Branson's Virgin Galactic that are, you know, these billionaires are pouring their own money into their companies with the idea of trying to get more and more people to space and to do it much more efficiently, much more affordably and reliably. And there could also be first flights of human tourists. I mean, people, ordinary people, albeit wealthy ones, who could afford a ticket on a suborbital space tourist mission.
What do the NASA astronauts who go through extensive and, from what I can tell, very rigorous training to get that job, what do they think about somebody who has a big enough bank account being able to go up into space?
Well, when I talked to them about it, they said they were supportive of it. I mean, I think everyone wants it to be safe, but then their point of view is that many, many more people should be able to get to space, that these astronauts know and they talk about in, you know, very sort of profound and personal ways about what going to space means to them and how it sort of changes their outlook on the world, on the environment, and, you know, what it means to be a human being even. I mean, I think there's sort of a profound, has a profound effect on them that if you see the Earth from a distance, you see countries without any boundaries or, you know, just how thin the atmosphere is that is protecting all life on Earth from, you know, the vast vacuum and void of space, that it has a profound effect, and that if more people could experience that, and then say if the suborbital flights are successful and they're able to do it, and that'll be a very big challenge, that could have a profound cultural effect, you know, a real effect on society. And these astronauts, they know what it's like to be up there. And they come back and they say there's even a name for it. It's called the overview effect. And they, you know, when I talked to them about it, they got emotional about it, and they said they wanted more people to be able to experience that.
Do you think that this new public-private partnership that seems to be happening, maybe not so new anymore, in some ways do you think that might be able to lead to more exploration if it's not all on NASA, not all on the federal government to do it?
Well, that's what NASA and the federal government are frankly hoping. You know, it started out under the Bush administration where NASA was hiring private companies to fly cargo and supplies to the International Space Station. Then, under President Obama, they awarded contracts to SpaceX and Boeing to fly crews, to fly NASA astronauts from U.S. soil on American rockets to the International Space Station. And those first flights could come, you know, again this year, early next. Now, under the Trump administration, there's talk of partnering with private industry to push out further, to go to the moon. Because I think that, you know, NASA realizes that, you know, their budgets have been relatively flat for a long, long time. You've got this new industry that's starting to creep up and has shown some success that's backed by some entrepreneurs with some very deep pockets. And, you know, the White House and NASA wants to leverage that and realize that they're not going to be able to do it alone. They need to partner with the commercial sector, and not just the commercial sector, but with other countries. And I think, you know, they're viewing this as a collective effort, but that will really harness the technology and the efficiencies of the private sector. And let's not forget, you know, these companies approach it very differently from NASA, you know, which is a big government bureaucracy that has to go with the whims of the White House or with Congress. But these companies are free to kind of push as they see fit. And they've got a lot of efficiencies and a real advantage in some ways over NASA to be able to do that.
Chris Davenport is a reporter with The Washington Post. He covers the defense and space industries. Chris, good to talk to you. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, Steve, this next one was kind of fun for me. It was all about possible new cracks in the case of D.B. Cooper.
I know that name, Mark, but bring us up to speed on it.
All right, so in 1971, a skyjacker parachuted out of a plane over Oregon with $200,000 and basically disappeared. A huge manhunt didn't find the suspect who came to be known as D.B. Cooper, although media outlets received a few letters supposedly from him after the fact. Back in August, we talked to Dennis Wagner, a reporter with the Arizona Republic, about a filmmaker who said he'd found the real D.B. Cooper. I asked Dennis, something of a D.B. Cooper buff himself, if there was really a break in the case after all these years, and here's what he said.
Yeah, I'd put an emphasis on the word maybe in that context. There is a group of guys, one of them is a filmmaker, and then he's got he says 40 investigators, many of them former FBI and other law enforcement, and they have been for some years focused on a retired Vietnam veteran who lives out in California. And this guy had been involved in some other crimes, and later on, he had become a construction guy after serving a prison term, and he'd worked as a university law instructor, and now he's retired in California, and they've been investigating him for a number of years. And this guy, Tom Colbert, the filmmaker, and his crew of sleuths claim that they have uncovered a code on those letters, an alphanumeric code that provides proof that an individual is D.B. Cooper.
All right, so there's this code that these people say that they have found in letters that this person wrote to media outlets. How did they figure out what this guy might have been saying or what he might have been trying to be saying through these letters?
It's pretty complicated. It might take more than a few minutes to explain, but I'll do the short version. So, for example, one of the codes that was actually written on the letter, whether it's code or not, we don't know, but one of the little sequences on the letter that didn't make sense was a series of seven C's. In the alphabet, C is the third letter. So this guy says that the suspect that they're looking at, his name is Robert Rackstraw, had been in psychological warfare ops and stuff and knew codes. So this one Vietnam veteran who'd served in the same unit started analyzing the letters. And this we'll take this one with the easy ones, seven C's in a row. C's the third letter in the alphabet. So he calculated that he was talking about the number 21.
Seven times three.
Seven times three is 21. And then this is where it really gets tricky as far as I'm concerned. He then said, what can we make out of the number 21 that is a word or something like that that would be a code? And he came up with ASA, which is 1 plus 19, S is number 19, plus A equals 21. ASA means Army Security Agency. And he decided the code was saying the word, the acronym Army for Army Security Agency. That's just one tiny example, but it gives you an idea of how this code supposedly works.
So has Rackstraw said anything about this? I mean, has he responded to these folks saying, hey, you're D.B. Cooper, aren't you?
So we got to go back in time again because this covers years and years. This crime occurred in 1971 in the late 1970s. Rackstraw was investigated for the murder of his stepfather. He was acquitted on that and for check kiting and fraud connected to some of his stepfather's finances. And he was convicted on those charges. This is all according to court records. At that time, police started realizing there was a visual resemblance between Rackstraw and FBI sketches of D.B. Cooper, and that he had what they called a skill set that fit. So from that point on, Rackstraw has been looked at on and off as a possible D.B. Cooper, and he was interviewed about it, and he was always extremely coy.
Now, there is an Arizona connection to the story that you write about in your article. This guy apparently learned how to jump out of airplanes or learned how to parachute here in Arizona?
Right. So part of this story is while in jail in California back in the late 1970s, Rackstraw went to a television station and offered to tell the truth story of D.B. Cooper. And they asked him, so what are you going to give us as proof? Because how do we know you're telling the truth? And he said, well, here's one example, according to the court records. I learned to fly, or I learned a parachute from my uncle in Arizona, my uncle Ed Cooper. And he taught me over by Apache Junction how to do this. And that's where I came up with the last name Cooper for the hijacker. I mean, even that part of the story gets convoluted because the initials DB were never used by the hijacker. He wrote on the manifest of the airplane or on his login for the airplane, he was Dan Cooper, and the DB was apparently constructed by some news outlet and picked up and never left.
So you've done quite a bit of research into this case. Do you get the sense, based on the people you've talked to and the research you've done, that we'll ever know who DB Cooper actually was?
I get the sense that it will be debated forever, just like the Kennedy assassination, that there are enough plausible suspects out there, enough evidence pro and con for various theories, that you can just have a field day arguing about it. And the conspiracy theorists can make it much worse and have over the years. Just one example of what a rabbit hole it is, and that is the court records show. And those court records, by the way, the guy that has this theory, this Tom Colbert, he has sued the FBI for documents on this. And the FBI has purportedly over 71,000 pages
wow.
on the D.B. Cooper case. So you can just imagine trying to pour through those and sort out who's who, what's what, and what's true.
That's Dennis Wagner, investigative reporter for the Arizona Republic. Dennis, thanks a lot for coming in.
Yeah, sure.
And on this New Year's Eve, you're listening to the show. It's the show on KJZZ. Thanks for listening today. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody.
If you're just joining us, we're replaying some favorite stories of 2018 to mark this New Year's Eve. And this next one took us on a relaxing
and scientific
journey into the heart of monsoon season. It was produced by the show's Lauren Gilger and Annika Klein.
The monsoon storms in the valley bring walls of dust, then sheets of rain. And then there comes my favorite part, the smell. It's like the whole desert takes a deep breath and opens up. The distinct scent of creosote fills the air. Today in our series on the monsoon season, how the monsoon tickles our senses, starting with the smell of the post-rain desert. They say smell is the sense that's closest tied to memory, and that proved true for listener Jamie Alkenbrack, who called in to tell us her story.
One of my favorite monsoons was when I was 6 years old and my family had gone out to the desert in between Phoenix and Carefree. This was way back in the day, 20, 30 years ago, and there wasn't much out there. And a monsoon had filled a wash, and it was just churning full of brown, frosty water. And it was amazing to watch what was once dry, parched earth come to life. And that smell of wet, damp desert and creosote is always just a wonderful, happy memory for me.
Well, there is a reason the desert smells like this after the rain.
Some certain types of plants have these oils inside them, and whenever it rains, it helps to wash these oils out, so things that were inside the plant, you can now smell because they're on the outside.
And that means it's time for a little science lesson with Harvard atmospheric scientist Matthew Cappucci.
And that's why it smells so strongly after one of these summertime storms.
In fact, you know that phrase, I can smell a storm coming? Well, it's true, and that scent is lightning.
So when lightning hits, it's 55,000 degrees Fahrenheit, about five times warmer than the surface of the sun, and it splits the air molecules apart. So you have these little oxygen molecules, they partner with themselves, you have oxygen and oxygen, splits them apart, and sometimes they recombine, so you have three oxygen atoms together, and that's ozone, that stuff way high in the sky, but it's kind of rare to get down at the surface. And so we can smell it in very low concentrations, down to only 10 parts per billion, the equivalent of about two or three teaspoons in an Olympic-sized swimming pool. And sometimes that lightning-produced ozone gets swept up in the winds ahead of the storm, so we actually literally smell the lightning before the storm even arrives.
In fact, Cappucci says, monsoon storms in the Sonoran Desert are some of his favorite to watch, and there's a science behind how they work, too.
So a thunderstorm, I always tell people, is a bit like an engine. It has intake, so the updraft, the air that goes up into it, and then when it spits out as well, you have this storm extract the heat from the air and produce this cool downburst of winds that heads towards the ground. And eventually, it can't go through the ground, so it has to fan out, and that produces what we call an outflow boundary, basically the leading edge of cooler air in advance of the storm. Now, sometimes in really dry climates, those winds to 60 miles an hour can really kick up the dust enough that it starts to rise high in the sky. So essentially with a haboob, you get this mile-high wall of dust moving at you at speeds 40, 50 miles an hour. It can be pretty dangerous.
Most of the year here, our weather reports are pretty simple, sunny and dry with various degrees of hot, until monsoon season. And it's that contrast that Cappucci says makes this season here truly remarkable.
There are very few places on Earth that have it with that dramatic of a swing and produce scenery that beautiful.
We all know that sound because monsoon storms, they like to announce their arrival. That boom of thunder can travel for miles, advertising the storm that's coming. Now, we here at the show, of course, love sound, and the sound of a rainstorm is a special favorite of our very own Annika Klein, a producer here at the show. And she got way closer to that sound this season than she'd bargained for.
I'm in my home, and this is the first real monsoon of the season. This is me recording a storm in early July in the comfort of my own home. I cracked the front door a little to capture the splash of water cascading off the roof. And then it was safely back inside to enjoy the soft, muffled tap dance of raindrops outside the house.
And even a light rain on like a tin roof, that's a beautiful sound.
That's Christine Haas. She's an avid rain listener, too. She's actually a soundscape ecologist, a really cool title for someone who records sound in nature. Her sound collection includes the eerie call of coyotes and the swell of cicadas in chorus.
It's ear-opening instead of eye-opening. And suddenly there's a whole lot of things out there that you just filtered out before that you can't anymore.
And if rainstorms formed a band, Christine would be their record producer. One of the first things Christine recorded was this thunderstorm, ambling toward her while she hung out at a pit stop in Utah during a long drive toward Arizona. It's that distant rumble, the muffled tapping, that makes me feel calm when I listen to rain. It's something you could fall asleep to. But then last month, I found myself inside a tent at a campground in northern Arizona and had a rude awakening. Where it was sunny just 30 minutes before, rain now battered the thin tent fabric. The wind pulled at the rainfly, and I could have sworn each clap of thunder was right above our campsite. We bailed. But in that half hour of waiting and listening, the sound of the monsoon season was transformed for me. This wasn't something you could fall asleep to. It sounded like the sky was ripping in half. When I told Christine this story, she laughed and shared this insight with me.
So much of the sounds we hear on a day-to-day basis are annoying and irrelevant. So we tune them out. And it's almost become a survival mechanism. In order to function, we have so much we have to tune out.
She says we may not realize how much natural noise we tune out too. The sounds that used to be key to our survival now are covered in a blanket of man-made noise. Until you get stuck in a rainstorm in a forest.
And I think, part of what you experienced in the tent was basically being captive. You didn't have anything else to distract you.
And on the drive away from camp, I was held captive too, only able to look at the road ahead and watch one of the best lightning shows I've ever seen. For the show, I'm Annika Klein.
All right, Steve, I hope you're ready to rehash what was possibly the biggest controversy of 2018.
Wow, so it must be a political thing. I'm really not sure what you're referring to.
All right, well, let me refresh your memory with a conversation I had with our co-host Lauren Gilger back in May.
Laurel.
Okay, so clearly that says Laurel, right?
It does not. I hear Yanny.
Are you, how? how? I don't understand.
It's just
that at
there's
all.
A very obvious long E at the end of that, to my ears anyway.
Gosh, I do not hear it. Okay, so some people like me who are right swear that they hear Laurel, and some say there's no way it could be anything other than Yanny.
Because there is no way it can be anything other than Yanny. But the question is, because, you know, Lauren and I have different opinions on this, how can people hear two different words from the same piece of audio?
Okay, so that has been the question in the first hour since that first tweet. So some people have said they can hear both at once. Others say the clip sounds different on different devices. But it has become pretty clear that both words do exist in the same piece of audio at the same time, however loyal you might be to Team Yanny or Team Laurel. So we tasked our producer, Annika Klein, with helping us break this down. So she removed some of the high frequencies from the original clip. Here's what that sounds like.
Laurel. Laurel.
Now that is totally Laurel.
Right. Okay. So that's what I heard too. But there's also this clip with some of the low frequencies removed.
Yanny. Yanny.
Yanny, right?
No, I still hear Laurel.
Still? All right. So Steve, which one did you hear? Laurel or Yanny?
I tell you, Mark, but I really don't want to stir up the interwebs all over again. So let's just leave this controversy behind in 2018.
Yanny. The correct answer is Yanny.
And you're listening to the show.
It's the show, and this is a special New Year's Eve edition of the program.
The song many of us sing at midnight, Auld Lang Syne, means in rough translation, for old time's sake, and the lyrics invite old friends to remember their journeys together. Take a cup of kindness yet for old time's sake, it says, and I guess that leads to our coverage of the death and memorial of the late Senator John McCain.
On August 30th, thousands of mourners gathered at North Phoenix Baptist Church to say goodbye to Senator McCain. They included former Vice President Joe Biden, who spoke about his longtime friend. The two met in the late 1970s when Senator McCain served as the Navy's liaison to the Senate. Biden started by making everyone laugh.
My name's Joe Biden. I'm a Democrat. And I love John McCain.
The former vice president, who of course ran against McCain in the 2008 election with Barack Obama, said the nation was hit hard by Senator McCain's death, a sentiment beyond politics and policy. Here's an excerpt of Joe Biden's tribute to his friend and colleague that we carried on the show.
You know, I'm sure as my former colleagues and all who work with John, I'm sure there's people who have said to you, not only now, but the last 10 years, explain this guy to me. Right? Explain this guy to me. Because as they looked at him, in one sense, they admired him, but in one sense, the way things have changed so much in America, they look at him as if John came from another age, that he lived by a different code, an ancient, antiquated code where honor, courage, character, integrity, duty, where it mattered, because that was obvious how John lived his life. But the truth is, John's code was ageless, is ageless. When you talked earlier, Grant, you talked about values. It wasn't about politics with John. He could disagree on substance, but it was the underlying values that animated everything John did. Everything he was, you'd come to a different conclusion. But were he part company with you, if you lacked the basic values of decency, respect, knowing that this project is bigger than yourself. John's story is the American story. That's not hyperbole. It sounds like it's the American story, grounded in respect and decency, basic fairness, the intolerance for the abuse of power. Many of you have traveled the world. Look how the rest of the world until recently looks at us. They look at us as a little naive. We're so fair. We're so decent. We're the naive Americans. But that's who we are. That's who John was. he could not stand the abuse of power wherever he saw it, in whatever form, in whatever country. It's always about basic values, John: fairness, honesty, dignity, respect, giving hate no safe harbor, leaving no one behind, and understanding that as Americans, we're part of something much bigger than ourselves. With John, it was a value set that was neither selfish nor self-serving. John understood that America was first and foremost an idea, audacious and risky, organized around not tribe, but around ideals. Think of how he approached every issue. The ideals that Americans have rallied around for over 200 years, the ideals that the world has repaired to, an idea enshrined in the Constitution. Sounds corny. We hold these truths self-evident, that all men are created equal, endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights. To John, those words had meaning, as they had for every great patriot that has ever served this country. Look, I've been thinking this week about why John's death has hit the country so hard. Yes, he was a long-serving senator with a remarkable record. Yes, he was a two-time presidential candidate who captured the support and imagination of the American people. And yes, John was a war hero who demonstrated extraordinary courage. I think of John, and I must say my son, when I think of Ingersoll's words, when the will defies fear, when duty throws the gauntlet down to fate, when honor scorns to compromise with death, that is heroism. Everybody knows that about John. But I don't think it fully explains why the country has been so taken by John's passing. I think it's something more intangible. I think it's because they knew John believed so deeply and so passionately in the soul of America that he made it easier for them to have confidence and faith in America. His faith in the core values of this nation made them somehow feel it more genuinely themselves. His conviction that we as a country would never walk away from the sacrifices generations of Americans have made to defend liberty and freedom and human dignity around the world, it made average Americans proud of themselves and their country. His belief, and it was deep, that Americans can do anything, withstand anything, achieve anything, was both unflagging and ultimately reassuring, if this man believed that so strongly. His capacity that we truly are the world's last best hope, that we're the beacon to the world, that there are principles and ideals greater than ourselves and worth suffering, sacrificing for, and if necessary, dying for. Americans saw how he lived his life that way, and they knew the truth of what he was saying. I just think he gave Americans confidence.
That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.